politics, agendas, side deals, partnerships, betrayals. These are the evils of the world I know. These are the things I have no desire to chase. Willow is his own man, his own entity. Willow has no interest in playing games. You have your issues. Joe has his issues. None of those issues involve Willow. I'll strike when it's my time. Later, MVP.
What kind of drugs do you take? What the hell is wrong with you?
The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Welcome to episode 319 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. Here for Sunday, March 23rd, 2014, I am the Solid Monster. You can listen to this podcast each and every Sunday afternoon on thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, or iTunes. Plus, we have a free app in the Google Play Store if you have an Android device. We're all over the place, and I thank you for downloading the podcast. This week's show is brought to you by Audible.com. You can sign up right now for a free 30-day trial of the Audible service. If you go to audibletrial.com/solidmonster, that's the link that you can use to help this show. If you go there, you can browse around, see what audiobooks are available. And sign up, you get a free month of the service, and as part of your free trial, you get one free audiobook that you get to keep whether you continue beyond your trial or not. You get one free audiobook regardless. And I've heard from a lot of you guys who have signed up, and thank you, by the way, for those who have. And people seem to really enjoy it. So if you're into reading, if you're not into reading, but you want something to listen to when you're on your commute to work, to school, you're at the gym, Audible is an interesting service, I think, that you might want to look into. And when you do, do it at audibletrial.com/solidmonster because that'll kick a little bit back to the show and help us out. So if you do that, post online in our Facebook group, Facebook page, send me a tweet, let me know what you think about it, and let me know what books you guys have picked up. Maybe there's some interesting choices that you can recommend to the rest of us to check out. Speaking of people who have helped out the show, I want to give some PayPal shout-outs here. We had a lot of people who contributed this week, and to make things fun here, I did say again that if you donate $10 or more, you get a wrestling nickname, because we have a lot of people who are very kind to the show. They do donate, you know, X amount, whatever it is, on a pretty routine basis. So I thought for those people, why don't we give them a wrestling nickname? And a lot of people last week took me up on that. Even more people this week took me up on that. So without any further ado, coming down the aisle, we have Eazy-E, Elliot Lee, Yovan Bruiser Balak, Sean Bulldog Bullen, Beautiful Bobby Younger, Callous Caleb Dotson, Danny the Chemist Carlisto, Hytham the Equalizer, Al Nawasser, Aran Lights Out Lewis, Zach House of Pain Hulker, Rel the Man from Hell, kind of like that one, Trevon Cannonball Clark, Travis Balls of Fury Blank, Jens the Swedish Fish, Kyle Poison Pill Petrano, Chris Percocet Payne, and maybe my favorite of all, John Pipelayer Pog. So there you go. Those are your PayPal nicknames this week. My thanks also to Leon Simmons as well. And if you want to donate to the Sound Off, you can do so on thesolidmonster.com. You'll see the donation box on the right-hand side. Again, $10 or more, I'll get you a nickname. I can't get everybody a nickname, so I figured I'd have to set a limit. And thank you all who donated. Hopefully you are not, especially Balls of Fury and the Pipelayer in particular, hopefully are appreciative of their nicknames, and they understand that they come from a good place. There's good intentions with those names. You should be proud of those names. I mean, shit, I wish I had Balls of Fury. And Laying Pipe, speaking of Laying Pipe, that brings me to my next subject here. I want to mention that one of our listeners, Marcus from Norway, is... I know somebody who's going to be Laying Pipe in New Orleans WrestleMania weekend, because Marcus is getting married. He is getting married in New Orleans. No family. They are not, he and his wife, or fiance, I guess, are not alerting their family as to their wedding intentions, because their family is kind of spread out in Austria, in Norway. They all can't make it, so they made the decision that if not everybody can come, then nobody can come. But what he is looking for are for people who can attend the wedding, who can maybe take pictures, shoot video, so they can look back and have some memories of this wedding. So it's a Norwegian wedding in New Orleans. If anybody is going down for WrestleMania weekend, you are cordially invited to this wedding. Now, I don't have all the details. I do know it's happening that Friday, the Friday before WrestleMania, April 4th, and the location, I guess, of the ceremony, it's at a Norwegian church in New Orleans. It's called the Norwegian Seamen Church in New Orleans. I mean, it's just, you can't make that up. And it's at 1772 Britannia Street, New Orleans, Louisiana, 70130. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's Prytania. That's the name of the street. I don't have any other details right now. I don't know what time the ceremony is. So if you want to follow along, I'm sure if you go on our Facebook group page, Marcus will post some information there, and I can maybe share some more next weekend. But he has invited people to attend. And again, if you can take pictures and shoot video, that would be fantastic, so they can remember their special night. So this is going to be a fun trip in New Orleans. I'm looking forward to it. I don't even know all of what I'm doing yet or all the different events yet, but we have a lot of plans, a lot of fun stuff, and of course we'll also do a roundtable sound-off when we're down there. But I just wanted to mention the Norwegian wedding there for Marcus and his bride-to-be. And speaking of our Facebook group page, last week on the sound-off I mentioned that My name for Daniel Bryan's finishing move, I don't know if he is calling it Knee Plus. I don't think it even has a real official name. It's still called the Flying Knee. But I suggested the Dragon Knee just because it sounds cool, okay, and his connection to the word dragon in the past. He started out as the American Dragon. So, Dragon Knee. Anyway, Kadeem on our Facebook page came up with an even better name than the Dragon Knee suggestion from last week. He suggested the Dragon Fly, which I actually think is very clever, which of course means they'll never use it. But I want to give him credit for that because I thought that was actually a very cool name. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from San Antonio, Texas. Run through some of the key segments here. Triple H, Randy Orton, and Batista opened the show. Both very upset with Hunter for giving in to Bryan's demand that if he wins at WrestleMania, he is inserted into the title match. And Triple H tells him, "Not to worry, I got this. What are you guys so worried about? Are you doubting me?" And Batista said the only reason Daniel Bryan is popular with the fans is because Randy Orton sucks as the champion. Called him a paper champion. That makes two paper champions that we have in wrestling right now. Although Magnus is worse, at least Orton wins some of his matches clean. When was the last time Magnus won a match in TNA without any sort of interference? Exactly. The Triple H deal here in this segment is he got angry at their bickering back and forth. He cut a really good, angry Triple H promo. We haven't seen him this angry in a long time. He riffed on Batista as a guy coming back from Hollywood who thinks he can tell him how to do his job. Certainly seemed to me like a... Obviously, you know, Batista has gone and had some success in Hollywood, but, you know, when Triple H makes comments like this, I always see it as like a subtle jab at The Rock. I've said it before, I think Triple H has always been jealous of The Rock. I don't know him personally. I just, you know, you listen to little comments that are made, and even, you know, Shawn Michaels in the past has made little comments, and it still sticks in his craw that The Rock went on to become a big star. Would not be the first time that he has taken a jab at The Rock in a promo. So he turned his venom at that point on Randy Orton, said, "You know what, we're going to have a triple threat for the title of WrestleMania no matter what, because when I beat Daniel Bryan, I am going to be in the match of WrestleMania." So if Hunter beats Bryan, he gets his spot in the main event. And with that, stock in Rolaids went through the roof, thanks to wrestling fans worried that Triple H may walk out of Mania with the title. I love this. I thought it was a brilliant little twist because it makes the match with Bryan a little less predictable. And it plants the seeds of doubt in the minds of all the Triple H haters. And there's a lot of them. There's a lot of people who just absolutely hate everything that Triple H is about. They are disgusted by him. They won't give him any credit at all as being a good wrestler or having a good wrestling mind. Even the stuff he's done in developmental, I think he's done an awesome job, you know, with NXT. Doesn't matter. There are people out there who just absolutely hate his guts, like the John Cena haters. There are people who hate John Cena. You cannot make any sort of argument that John Cena has any redeemable qualities at all whatsoever. Some people just don't want to hear it. And so they're playing off the hatred that people have for this guy. And I think now the match is even more dramatic. There's even more at stake. And so I love it. You know, Brian's still winning. But I wouldn't rule out the possibility that Triple H could end up inserting himself into the title match regardless. Maybe he takes out Brian in a fit of rage after Brian beats him and they play up his injuries. And when the main event comes around, you know, there's no Brian. But Triple H claims his spot instead. And then midway through, here comes Brian and, you know, it turns into a four-way. I could see them doing something along those lines, but... You know, make no mistake about it, Daniel Bryan is beating Triple H, and he's going to the main event. You know, this is just, the story can't go any other way. So, you know, Triple H is not burying anybody, he's not winning the title. I'm more shocked that people actually believe that than anything else. There are people out there who are convinced that Triple H is walking out of New Orleans with the championship, and it just, look, anything can happen, but it just blows my mind that, you know, rational, normal people actually think that that's going to be the end of WrestleMania. It's not. Calm down. It's not. We had the Real Americans beating the Usos, which lines them up for a shot at the tag team titles at WrestleMania. Cesaro definitely cut that promo last week. I think it was on the German version of Raw or whatever, talking about being in the Battle Royal. So I guess plans change. He's no longer in, or maybe he will, and he'll pull double duty. On main event, they lost clean to the Rhodes Brothers. Cesaro and Swagger lost, and the New Age Outlaws were back on SmackDown Friday. So, you know, I thought maybe we would get a four-way at the pay-per-view for the titles, but apparently not. Apparently the Rhodes Brothers are in the Battle Royal. They're the odd men out, and they're going to go with a three-way with the Usos, the Outlaws, and Cesaro and Swagger, which is kind of interesting. Bad News Barrett was out to talk about how everybody would get drunk on St. Patrick's Day and be hungover the next morning as though there's something wrong with that. I'm just wondering, is Barrett physically incapable of wrestling a match? I see his name listed on the house show results, so apparently he's wrestling, but I can't remember the last time I saw him in a match on TV. Sheamus came out, he beat Titus O'Neil. Christian was on commentary for this match, the most underappreciated man on the WWE roster. He got his revenge on JBL for calling him ugly week after week by saying he looked like David Spade in a fat suit. And he could have just said he looked like David Spade and left it at that. That would have been enough of an insult. JBL then asked if they could put a blue dot over Christian's commentary, which I admit, I did laugh at that. After the match, Christian attacked Sheamus, gave him the kill switch on the floor. Both men in the Andre the Giant Battle Royal at WrestleMania, so poor Sheamus. If he was lined up for a match with Daniel Bryan, to go from that to a spot in the Battle Royal that he's probably not winning is quite the demotion. John Cena was out for a promo. He admitted that he is afraid of Bray Wyatt. Not afraid enough, apparently, since he was cracking jokes about him the week before. At least now he's admitting he's afraid of the homeless man in his fedora. He's afraid that the fans may be buying into what Wyatt has been saying about him, that Bray is out to destroy his legacy. I like that they had John Cena admit to fearing the guy, but these Cena promos just, you know, they ring hollow to me. And it goes back to the build for his first match with The Rock. All those weeks on television of, I have to win this match, Rock. I have to win this match. If I don't, my career is over. And my legacy is shattered, all that kind of stuff. And what happened? Absolutely nothing. Not only did nothing happen, I remember a few months later on TV, maybe even a month or two, Cena's in a segment with Vince McMahon openly mocking the fact that he lost to The Rock at WrestleMania, like it's a joke. Now I'm supposed to care that his legacy is going to be ruined if he loses this one match? This is what happens. This is what happens when you do that. I like this promo. I just couldn't believe a thing he was saying. So, in that way, I guess Bray Wyatt is telling the truth when he calls Cena a liar. Wyatt popped up on the Titantron, decked out in John Cena gear. He had the neon shirt on, the neon wristbands. Talked about Cena's plastic girlfriend. That was an awesome line. And true, too. Nikki Bella did an interview, I forgot where. She claimed that she did not know that line was coming. I don't believe that, but that's what she says. He says he's different than any other opponent John Cena has ever faced. He's willing to die to show the world the kind of man that John Cena really is. I don't think it's even close with Punk gone that Bray Wyatt is easily the best promo in wrestling right now. Can we all agree on that, that he is the number one guy right now? Later in the show, they aired a music video for the match set to Eminem's new song, Legacy. Never in a million years thought that Eminem would fit with Bray Wyatt, but that's one of the best promos I've ever seen them do. Not quite as good as the Placebo one they did with Undertaker and Shawn Michaels, that Running Up the Hill, Running Up This Hill song, but pretty close. Wyatt, is the interesting thing about Cena and Wyatt at WrestleMania, I'm getting into this match a little bit more each week, and it's more because of Bray Wyatt than John Cena. John Cena has really done nothing different than he does in every other match, but I'm really digging Wyatt's work, his promos, I'm really liking it, and so I'm into the match. And the thing is, he doesn't have to beat Cena at WrestleMania. He doesn't have to. But man, I really hope he does. I really do. How huge would that be for him? To pin John Cena at WrestleMania? He's already got a win over Daniel Bryan. Bryan wins the title, he's got a ready-made challenger after Orton gets his rematch. They can save the Batista title win for the summer when his movie comes out. And the way I look at it, Batista isn't due a rematch after WrestleMania if he loses anyway, because he's not the champion. So you can easily transition him into something else for a few months, and you can have Bryan and Bray Wyatt for the WWE title. It's not as unlikely as some people may think. Some people may look at that, oh, that's not a championship main event. I'd have no problem with it. They had an awesome match at the Royal Rumble, and Bray beat him clean. So why wouldn't that set him up as the number one contender after WrestleMania if he beats John Cena? Of course, if he loses to John Cena, then it makes no sense. Randy Orton and Daniel Bryan had a no disqualification match. Good match. These two have worked together so many times, I think it would be hard for them not to have a good match. I don't think there's ever been a potential WrestleMania main event where the two participants, or two of them anyway, have had this many matches beforehand. I said this on Twitter, and people gave me a whole bunch of examples of guys who have wrestled each other before, but I think they misunderstood what I was saying. I'm talking in the lead-up to WrestleMania, not their entire careers. Obviously, you know, before WrestleMania 19, Rock and Austin, yes, they had a whole bunch of matches, but it's not like Rock and Austin wrestled in the 3 or 4 months before WrestleMania 19. Actually, it had been a long-ass time before that match, since the last Austin Rock match. So I'm talking more like the last 6 months, 6 months or less. In just the last 6 months, the number of matches these two have had on TV and on pay-per-view is just ridiculous. You know, normally you keep the two guys apart to make the Mania match feel more special. Yet another piece of evidence that they weren't planning on Daniel Bryan being in the main event this year, I think, is how many frickin' matches they've put them in on TV. You would think if they knew ahead of time that these two were going to be in the WrestleMania main event, they would have kept them apart a little bit more. Orton was awesome midway through the match. He hit Bryan in the head with a kendo stick shot on the outside, and some fan in the crowd shouted, "Ring the bell!" And Orton snapped and just went crazy on the guy.
It's no DQ! Ring the bell! You kidding me? There's no bell to ring!
Heel Dick Randy Orton can actually be very entertaining when he wants to be, and that was one of those moments. Batista ran in, speared Orton as revenge for Orton laying him out with an RKO in the opening segment. Bryan got the pin. After the match, Batista laid out Orton with a Batista bomb. He did this in his skinny jeans, too, which was very impressive. We got a Paul Heyman video on The Undertaker, all the men that Brock Lesnar has destroyed over the years. No CM Punk anywhere to be seen, even though it would have made sense to show Brock killing Punk and beating him at SummerSlam last year. You know, Punk lost that match. But I guess, you know, he's kind of persona non grata right now in WWE, that they don't even want to acknowledge him. You know, because it's all part of the work, of course. Isn't that right? I really like this because the video focused on how much older The Undertaker is getting. This is the first time I think WWE has made Undertaker's age an issue in a storyline. Because, you know, a guy like The Undertaker, you don't want to call him old. Everybody knows he is, but you don't want to call him that on TV. You want to build him up. He's this unstoppable force. Nobody can beat him. And now they're starting to realize that, okay, everybody knows that he's getting a little slower, he's getting a little older, he looks like my grandpa now, and we have to somehow incorporate that into the storyline, and I like that, because I agree with that. You can't ignore it. You may as well make it part of the story. make him seem vulnerable. The whole thing with the streak is there aren't very many people who think the streak is ever going to end. Because The Undertaker is rarely vulnerable. I mean, he could take a beating in a match, but in the end, everybody knows he's going to get the pin or the submission, and he's going to win. And some people will just never be convinced otherwise, and I don't think the streak will ever end, but I like them to at least try to do stuff that plants the seeds of doubt, and so those people maybe would look at it and go, well, huh, maybe Undertaker wants to lose, and maybe, you know, he's handpicked this guy to kind of do the honors for at WrestleMania. I mean, you just, it's hard because there are people who just will never be convinced otherwise, but you can try. So I appreciate them at least trying. And the other reason I like it, you know, I mentioned this last week, if Sting is coming in, and there's no further update on Sting, I don't think we're going to have any sort of update on Sting until the moment he shows up on TV, which I'm convinced he will. But if he's coming in, you should do it at WrestleMania and have him help The Undertaker as a way to preserve the streak for himself next year. And it plays into the story that they're telling with him being a lot older. And each passing year, it's a lot harder for The Undertaker to win and to keep the streak alive. So, you know, Sting pops up, a couple baseball bat shots to Brock, Tombstone 1-2-3. Undertaker didn't ask for his help, but it's as though he needed help in order to, you know, slay the beast. And Sting points the bat at him and says, you're next. I want to be the one to break the streak. So it all kind of fits together if that's the direction they want to go in. Speaking of Sting, I do have one update, actually. He's going to be in New Orleans doing a signing at WrestleCon the day of WrestleMania that afternoon. I think it goes from like 10:30 to 2:30, I think. So if anybody's going to be in New Orleans, you want to meet Sting and get a picture or whatever, that's the day to do it. He doesn't do too many of these appearances. I think this is his first U.S. appearance since he left TNA. He did that Q&A over in the U.K., but he hasn't done much since, and, you know, he is going to be in town. He will be in New Orleans the day of WrestleMania, so there is that. Undertaker was also on Main Event this week, delivering a message for Paul Heyman to take back to Brock, and Undertaker sounded an awful lot like Batman, the Christian Bale version. You know, like, where is she? You tell Brock at WrestleMania he's gonna rest in peace. You tell him that. Blah, blah, blah. Actually, that sounded kind of more like the John Laurinaitis version of Batman. So yeah, this is like a John Laurinaitis. Imagine John Laurinaitis wearing a Batman mask. I imagine that's probably what he would sound like. Undertaker will be in Brooklyn this Monday. He did say that. Arnold Schwarzenegger and The Undertaker together in Brooklyn at the same time this Monday. That's one way to cut the crime rate around here. Goldust pinned Fandango in a bad match. A lot of botched spots. Goldust visibly pissed off, even though he won the match, which kind of makes no sense if you think about it. You won the freaking match. What are you so pissed off about? It looked like he may have hurt himself on a botched Hurricanrana, but he looked okay on Main Event the next night, so I assume Goldust is doing fine. We had a segment where Kane blamed Jerry Lawler for the Occupy Raw segment in Memphis. Of course, King Lawler is the king of Memphis, and so I guess Kane argues here that Lawler rounded up a bunch of people and helped cause Triple H essentially to get the WrestleMania Main Event changed by giving into Bryan's demand. So he called Lawler into the ring to be destroyed by The Shield. But The Shield did the old ECW turn from that episode of Raw during the invasion where all the former ECW guys who were now in WWE slowly turned around and they attacked. Ironically, they attacked Kane and Chris Jericho, if I remember. Yeah, I think they did, actually. How about that? So, because that was the night Tommy Dreamer and Rob Van Dam made their debut in WWE. They ran in during a tag match. I think it was Jericho and Kane against Lance Storm and somebody else. I still remember this. You know, I still remember that because it was such a freaking awesome angle. It was so great, that angle. And then an hour later, Stephanie McMahon is the new owner of ECW, and they just fucked it all up. So, anyway, The Shield beat down Kane instead. They left him for dead with the triple power bomb. And they stand united for now. On SmackDown, they got beat down by Kane and the New Age Outlaws. So it looks like it's going to be The Shield against Kane and the Outlaws at WrestleMania. That kind of came out of nowhere, I think. You know, whatever happened to the Outlaws getting their tag team title rematch? That whole thing is even more confusing to me. I read that the Outlaws want to work with the Shield. That's all well and good. Work with them after WrestleMania. How about things make a little more sense? You know what I mean? Why not put the Outlaws in with the Usos and the Real Americans and the Rhodes Brothers and have a fatal four-way for the tag titles? And you keep... I mean, think about this, okay? Because we found this out on SmackDown as well. Here's how weird this whole situation is. On Main Event, the Rhodes Brothers pin the Real Americans, which you would think would set up a three-way or a four-way for Mania involving them. But on SmackDown, we found out that it's going to be the Usos defending against the Real Americans and Axelback. Ryback and Curtis Axel. Two more guys who did promos on Raw this week, in fact, talking about winning the Battle Royal. And now they're seemingly out of it. Again, unless everyone's pulling double duty on this show. So, you know, they got the shot for assisting Kane and beating down the Shield. That was their reward, a tag team title shot. Same thing with Swagger and Cesaro. So that's how those matches have worked out. I don't know anybody who would have predicted that that's how the Shield match would have turned out and that's how the tag team title match would have turned out. They've done nothing with Ryback and Curtis Axel. You know, so for them to get a tag team title match at WrestleMania, you know, I mean, I don't know about that one. Naomi is back. She's got a glittery eye patch on. She and Cameron beat AJ and Tamina after Naomi pinned AJ with a split-legged moonsault. She stole RVD's move. Wonder if that means he's not coming back. Actually, if I had a guess, I would think Van Damme will probably be in that Battle Royal as a surprise entrant. I made a remark about Naomi's ass, which is a fine specimen, I have to say. And Samuel, one of our listeners, said, it's fitting that Naomi has a pirate eye patch because she's harboring all the booty. Samuel, you are a great man. After the match, AJ blamed Tamina for her losing streak, and Tamina shoved her on her ass. Yes, this looked like an exact copy of the Gail Kim, Lady Tapa angle from Impact last week. Although, in fairness, AJ and Tamina apparently made up in time for SmackDown on Friday, and they have been building to an issue between the two of them, going back to her loss to Cameron at Elimination Chamber when Tamina got AJ disqualified. So it's not like this came out of nowhere like it did on Impact. The Gail Kim Lady Tapa thing made no sense, although now it does, I guess, because as it turned out, they fired Lady Tapa. We'll get into that during the TNA review. Mr. T, officially announced for the WWE Hall of Fame, well-deserved. Can't see anybody other than Hulk Hogan being the one to induct him. So maybe that's why Linda McMahon is doing the Ultimate Warrior induction. They wanted Hogan to do it, and maybe a spot opened up because they wanted Hogan with Mr. T, and then Warrior said, hey, I want Linda. Because it was Warrior's choice. He wanted Linda McMahon to induct him, and I can only assume that they share similar political views, and he has a lot of respect for her, and so that's why he wanted her. Because beyond that, I have no idea why Linda McMahon would be the one to induct the Ultimate Warrior, but... We'll see. Maybe she can muster up enough fire, you know, in her speech. I've never seen a Linda McMahon speech with fire before. She's always just very monotone, you know. Her doing an induction for the Ultimate Warrior of all people just seems very weird to me. For anybody wondering what happened to the angle with The Miz walking out to the ring in the middle of people's matches and bitching about his push, well... Plans change, I guess. He did pop up on Backstage Pass as an analyst, if anybody cares, which apparently nobody does, since nobody has emailed me one time to ask what has happened to The Miz lately. I have not gotten one message about The Miz, so nobody cares. Big Show is in the Andre the Giant Battle Royal at WrestleMania. Of course he would be. He is the son of Andre, remember? Why wouldn't he be in there? He pinned Damian Sandow in an 8-man tag match full of potential and full of shattered dreams for many of the participants. I mean, it's a who's who of start and stop pushes and burials in WWE. Dolph Ziggler, Big E, Sandow, Ryback, Alberto Del Rio. So they're all in the Battle Royal as well. And to end the show, we had the Daniel Bryan Triple H face-off. Hunter puts over Bryan, says that the two of them are the best at what they do. Said he respects Daniel Bryan for not giving up through all the obstacles that they've thrown in front of him. A lesser man would have taken his ball and gone home, he said. And that got a CM Punk chant from the crowd, and rightfully so. There's no doubt about who that comment was aimed at. You have to think, nobody is more pissed at CM Punk than Triple H. Since it was his match that Punk bailed on. I would imagine there's probably some resentment there. So he said he respects Brian. This brought out Stephanie, who couldn't believe how soft her husband had gone. She was furious. She's so awesome in her role, Stephanie. I mean, her voice is like nails on a chalkboard when she screams, but she's very good in her role. Both of them, actually, have been quite great lately. Stephanie wanted Brian arrested for the Occupy Raw segment in Memphis. Why would she think Texas cops would arrest Daniel Bryan for a crime in Tennessee? You know, a minor crime, a misdemeanor, if that. The cops, quote-unquote, circled Bryan in the ring. They forcibly held him down. They handcuffed his arms behind his back. Triple H called him off, said, "You're not even real cops. Get the hell out of here." And that opened the door for him to beat the crap out of Daniel Bryan. To say that he beat the crap out of him is actually kind of an understatement. He threw him shoulder first, head first, into the ring steps, into the barricade. He dropped him across the announce table. He hit him in the head with a chair. He laid him out with a pedigree. All of this with Brian's arms tied behind his back. You can't protect yourself. You can't brace yourself for impact. It looked dangerous. I like this. Triple H looked like the Triple H of old, back when he was on his A game as a heel. So, you know, we're going back 12 or 13 years here. I've always thought he was a much better heel than a babyface. He's really only been a heel since SummerSlam after being a babyface since 2006. That's a long time between heel Triple H runs. So I thought this was a powerful angle to close the show. Even much more now at stake in their match. And that makes it a little more intriguing and a little less predictable. So I don't see what there is to complain about. Other than, oh, Triple H is going to be in the main event. You know, I don't think he will be. And if he is, he's not winning, so who cares? Brian's going to walk out with the title. It's the only storyline ending that makes sense to all this. And they're claiming that Daniel Bryan is hurt, partially dislocated shoulder, ligament stretched, capsule swelling. No surgery necessary, but he has promised to be on Raw this Monday. So that is the storyline they're going for. I want to talk a little bit here about a fan survey that WWE sent out during the week in regards to the network. This was gauging people's reactions to potential network reality shows. Of course, they have Legends House, which is actually premiering next month. April 17th, I believe, is the date. It's going to be on Thursdays at 8 Eastern, so it'll be a lead into NXT. And they're already talking about a potential Season 2, maybe with some different Legends that they may film this summer, I guess depending on how things go with Season 1. So just to run through this list really quick of potential shows, the one that I think has the most potential and that I would love to see, and there's already a trailer for it on YouTube, though, the trailer is from 2012. So my guess is that whatever production company put this show together, what WWE is asking is, would people be interested in this show? And if so, they would pick it up, because there was a pilot film, but the pilot is already a few years old. It's for a show called Blackman's Bounties. Former WWE star and legit badass Steve Blackman gets his own reality series following his bounty hunting team based out of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I watched the trailer for it. I didn't even have to watch the trailer for it. As soon as I heard Steve Blackman bounty hunting reality show, I was sold. I don't see how anybody could not want to watch that. I want Blackman to bust into people's houses screaming, "It's party time!" How awesome would that be? And then the guy can look at him and go, "Hey, aren't you the guy from Head Cheese?" And then he can like beat him down and drag him out of the house. So, yeah, I mean, you can find it on YouTube. I think I posted a link to it on my Twitter as well. It's a very brief clip. They don't show too much. It is not, definitely not PG, which makes me wonder how much editing they would probably have to do to this thing. But even an edited version, I would be interested in seeing. Some of the other shows here, NXT Behind the Scenes, a reality series that follows the NXT stars trying to make it out of the Performance Center and to the main roster. So it looks at their work, their personal lives, and the fraternity of the NXT brand, including the heartbreak of being cut. That also sounds very interesting. I would not mind seeing a show like that. I don't know why Tough Enough isn't on this list. You know, I wouldn't mind seeing another season of Tough Enough, especially with Steve Austin hosting. Pros vs. Joes, which I think was a show on USA. Was it USA? No, Spike. I think it was on Spike TV at one point. Basically pits WWE talents against the average person in different physical and non-physical challenges. I can go either way on that. WWE around the world following talents, taking part in some of the scariest stunts and attractions around the world, such as shark diving and eating strange foods. I have no interest in seeing this. WWE Dirty Jobs, just like the, I guess, there's a Discovery Channel series of the same name. Talents have to perform unpleasant jobs, like going into the Chicago sewer system and picking up trash in New York City. Oh, that sounds riveting. Because if there's one thing I can't wait to see on the network, it's watching Zack Ryder pick up trash in New York. WWE Prankdown, practical joke show that features talents pulling tricks on unsuspecting superfans. One example is John Cena, Randy Orton both wanting to buy an expensive car and getting into a fight at the dealership, only to show the damage they caused was part of the show to trick the fan. Maybe. WWE Rescue, a reality show where talents come to the homes of superfans, help them with their personal and business problems. And WWE Ultimate Challenge, their version of The Amazing Race with a 12-hour extreme scavenger hunt in different cities. And Extreme WWE Collector, starring superfan Michael Patterson. Who the fuck is Michael Patterson, and why should I care? Those are the ones they listed. I have no interest in most of the ones on that list. The NXT one I wouldn't mind seeing, and the Blackman one, absolutely. I mean, I'm already sold. The only sad part about that, I was thinking about this. You know, Al Snow is an agent in TNA. He even popped up on Impact in a segment this past week. So, unfortunately, they can't do anything with Al Snow. Because the Al Snow-Steve Blackman tag team, Head Cheese, came back around 2000, was one of those guilty pleasure things. They were very, I thought they were so entertaining together and very funny. So I would love to see them do something with, like, Blackman and Snow. And I take it that Steve Blackman has a legitimate bounty hunting business, I guess. I thought he was running an MMA gym. Maybe he's doing both. But if they wanted to go in a different direction, you know, one thing I wouldn't mind seeing on the network, provided they actually bring in writers who know how to write comedy, unlike their own team, is something like a WWE sitcom, like a half-hour sitcom. And I just think a Steve Blackman, Al Snow, almost like a buddy cop type of sitcom, has a lot of potential. Like, imagine in that trailer for Blackman's Bounties, it's him and he has a partner. Well, forget the partner. What if Al Snow is his partner? And imagine the two of them driving around having to break into people's homes, and Blackman is serious and he's deadpan, and Al Snow, of course, has, you know, a sense of humor about him. And, you know, we're talking about a reality show here, but I'm thinking more along the lines of a sitcom. I think they can make something like that work if they have the right people. And I know they tried something many years ago with Santino and Kozlov. I think for the website, they had filmed some kind of, like, I don't know if it was like a sitcom pilot. I think they filmed it, but they never aired it. And then Kozlov got fired, so I guess they just ended up never using it. So they've had the idea before, but they never actually did anything with it. I mean, it all depends on who scripts it, because like I said, if it's the WWE guys scripting comedy, that usually doesn't work out too well. But you watch stuff on YouTube like the JBL and Cole show, which, yeah, I don't think it's scripted. Whoever's coming up with the concepts for that show is brilliant. Because I watch them, and they're only about 5 or 6 minutes long, each of those videos, but they're great. And they have storylines on them that continue from one show to the next. They have this thing now at Wrestler's Court, which is kind of funny. You know, if you wanted to do something for the network, I think that there would be a lot of people interested in that. But you got to use the right people. That's the key. And I think, I just keep thinking Blackman and Al Snow on a buddy cop type of show would be gold. But like I said, Al Snow's in TNA, so that can't happen. But a reality show with Steve Blackman breaking people's doors down, saying it's party time, swinging his nunchucks and his kendo sticks, I'm sold. NXT this week had Mojo Rawley, the opening match, beating Bull Dempsey, who they said hails from Brooklyn, New York. Indeed, I looked him up. He was trained by Taz. The announcers kept referring to him as a throwback to another era. He does kind of look like one of those enhancement guys you get to see smacked around each week on Wrestling Challenge. Even his name is kind of old school, you know, Bull Dempsey. I like it, but this wasn't the Bull Dempsey showcase. This was the Mojo Rawley show. New England Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski was shown in the crowd, so now we have celebrities on NXT. I guess he and Mojo have a history together. You know the drill. Dempsey works him over for a bit. Mojo catches his breath after running to the ring like the Ultimate Warrior. Comes back, hits Naomi's rear view, which, for the record, looks much better when Naomi does it. Then he nails the earthquake splash, which they're now calling hyperdrive, and off he goes into the crowd to celebrate with Gronkowski. CJ Parker did an interview backstage. He was wearing a suit. He is sickened by Mojo Rawley's lifestyle because he is genetically modified and highly processed. I can think of a few people on the WWE roster who are genetically modified. He said Mojo eats fast food, he burps, and throws the wrappers out the window. He is a polluter. So they're going to have a match next week on NXT. Tyler Breeze was supposed to have a match with Sami Zayn, but Corey Graves attacked Sami from behind, threw him into the ring post. Doctors checked on him. He sold it like he had a concussion, so they helped him to the back. Another win for Tyler Breeze. Give that man a title shot. No, really, I'm serious. Him and Adrian Neville had some good matches. Give him a title shot. Sheamus was being interviewed in the back when he was interrupted by Aiden English. Nothing of any note was said. They're having a match later. Adam Rose, the new golden boy of NXT, he was out next for a match with Camacho. They have already replaced Adam Rose's awesome theme music with a generic knockoff version. So his entrance was not as fun as it was for his debut, but it's still pretty great. All the developmental guys who aren't on TV yet come down to the ring with him dressed up as party goers. It's like one big party, 24-7, when this guy comes down to the ring and when he goes back up the aisle. Camacho got the advantage. Crowd chanted party pooper at him. I don't know where it happened, but Rose got a bloody mouth somewhere in here. He nailed a Bronco Buster, a spine buster, went to the corner. He yelled choo-choo, and he nailed a lariat for the win. I don't think he's calling it the slice anymore. The announcers haven't mentioned it. That's what he used to call it when he was Leo Kruger. It was a setup move. But he should call it that. I think it's a cool name. Bayley beat Sasha Banks with a roll-up in a match with Charlotte in Sasha's corner and who else? Natalya in Bayley's corner. It's true. Natalya gets more TV time on NXT than any other show. Except maybe Total Divas, but I haven't watched Total Divas since episode 3 or 4, I think, of season 1, so I wouldn't know. Charlotte nailed Natalya from behind on the outside at one point. Bayley got the win right after, and Natalya just kind of shrugged off the attack like it never happened, and she celebrated with Bayley. Aiden English made his entrance for the main event. He still sings on the way to the ring, but they did away with the background music. He used to have like piano keys playing in the background in tune with whatever he was singing. Now it's just him singing, and it's not as good. Sheamus came out, got a huge reaction, as you would expect. A real star. He started singing a song called The Irish Rover, and got the crowd to clap in rhythm along to it. And not for nothing, he was doing a good enough job that when Aiden English interrupted him, even I booed him. I wanted to hear Sheamus finish the song. I thought it was a catchy song that I had never heard before. And I don't know if any of our Irish listeners can chime in on this. I mean, is that a really popular song? Is it a children's song? I don't know. It's the first I've heard of it. So I had to go on YouTube. I looked it up. And I found the song. And for those of you who don't watch NXT, maybe you've never heard of the song before, I figured I would play a little bit of the song here and sing along to it because it's such a catchy tune. So let's cue up some of this Irish Rover here if we can. On the 4th of July, 1806, we set sail from the sweet cove of Cork. We were sailing away with a cargo of bricks for the Grand City Hall in New York. 'Twas a wonderful craft, she was rigged fore and aft, and oh, how the wild winds drove her. She'd got several blasts, she'd 27 masts, and we called her the Irish Rover. In New Orleans, I'm going to have to find an Irish pub, and I'm going to jump up on top, and I'm going to start singing this song. That was fun. Sheamus grabbed the mic back and continued singing. Only for a few seconds, English knocked him out of the ring. That pissed off Sheamus, and the chase was on. They had a decent match, maybe 10 minutes or so. English got a lot of offense in. Sheamus got his big comeback in the end and won with the bro kick. Probably the most competitive Aiden English match I've ever seen on NXT. He didn't win, but he shouldn't have won, given who he was in there with. Sheamus gave him a lot. He looked like a real threat, which is more than I can say for most of Aiden English's matches. So for him, I think this was a plus. And that was it. It was a shorter show, only about 50 minutes or so, but a good one. They did air a funeral parlor segment from 1991 with Roddy Piper and Virgil when it was over to tide us over until the top of the hour. So I forgive them for the show going short. Next week is Vengeance Week on NXT. Bo Dallas gets his rematch against Adrian Neville for the NXT Championship. Tyler Breeze faces Xavier Woods. Mojo Rawley kills CJ Parker, or we can hope. And Charlotte battles Natalya. So hopefully that'll pick things up a bit since they've been kind of in cruise control the past couple of weeks. Again, it was a good show, but nothing overly exciting. But at least next week we've got some big matches planned. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/Solomonster. It's another way to show your support for The Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Solomonster. It's time for the Impact Report. Impact this past Thursday night, another taped show from Orlando, Florida. One of the storylines throughout the show was Bully Ray waiting outside Dixie Carter's office at TNA headquarters in Nashville. And it all builds to this segment towards the end of the show where he's tired of waiting. He barges into her office. They have this dramatic music playing in the background. Not the first time we've seen a Bully Ray segment with dramatic music in the background. And the chair that supposedly Dixie Carter is sitting in at her desk is turned with the back to the camera, so we can't see if she's in the chair, except for the fact that we can clearly see there's nobody sitting in the chair, let alone somebody with big hair like she has. But there's Bully Ray standing there cutting a promo on her for like a minute straight. And he spins the chair around, and shockingly, nobody is sitting in the chair, like a dumb shit. And then Bobby Roode attacks him from behind and lays him out. Bobby Roode, the best heel in all of TNA, and he is anywhere close to the championship, which is a crime, but he is the best heel in the company. He lays out Bully Ray. The one criticism I have of that is he hit Bully Ray over the head with a cardboard poster. Now, this is not the first time that we have seen cardboard used as the ultimate weapon of death in TNA. As a matter of fact, I think it was on last week's show, and it might have been Bully Ray himself used cardboard on somebody, maybe EC3. We've seen cardboard used a few times now. Enough with the cardboard, please. It looks ridiculous. Show opened with a brawl backstage between Abyss and Eric Young. No referees bothered to break them up like they do every other impromptu fight in TNA, so eventually this spilled into the ring. Abyss nearly ended up choking EY to death over the ropes with a chain around his neck. He was hanging him. He was hanging him over the top rope. And Mike Tenay and Taz were so concerned about Eric's face turning purple, as Taz pointed out, they openly wondered if he'd be able to come back out later for the main event to be chained to Abyss. How thoughtful of them. EC3 beat Bobby Lashley by DQ when Willow, who you heard at the top of the podcast this week, attacked EC3, went after his knee. EC3 just barely escaped, so his undefeated streak remains intact. Lashley's a good athlete, you know, for a guy his size. He does an impressive leapfrog, for example. That's about the only thing about him that stood out here. We had the Gunner-James Storm segment. I wanted to talk about this also, because this probably was, if this wasn't the best part about Impact, it was up there with the tag title match. This wasn't a horrible show. I see, you know, some people just like nothing about Impact this week. It was not a good show, but there were parts of it that I did like, and this was one of them. Gunner came out, and Gunner has cut some really good promos in recent weeks, going back to the Impact tapings in the UK last month. He's done some of the best work on the microphone of his entire career, and this was up there. He had a great promo. His father was in the crowd, which is, you know, angle alert, hello. So he goes out there, he's talking about how much his father meant and how important it was for him to, you know, basically to make his father proud and all this emotional stuff. And James Storm comes out. He has new music, new heel music. And he told Gunnar's dad, he made fun of Gunnar's dad for crying. If you remember that video, that great video package about Gunnar's career they did, and he had comments from his mother and father, and in the video his father was crying. So he mocked his dad for crying, and he said that Gunnar's grandfather was looking down from heaven and thanking God that he was dead, which is very nice. And he called them both huge disappointments. Gunnar attacked Storm, a brawl ensued. Storm laid him out with the last call super kick, though, made him look like a fool. And he pulled out a pair of handcuffs. And he cuffed Gunnar. Basically, Gunnar's outside the ring, but he cuffed Gunnar's arms to the top rope. So he's basically just kind of hanging there helpless from the top rope. And then he grabbed Gunnar's dad in the front row, dragged him over, and kind of left him alone. And as Gunnar's dad went to go check on his son, James Storm looked down. He saw a beer bottle that he brought to the ring with him. And he's got evil intentions for that beer bottle, picks it up, and he smashes it across the back of Gunner's father's head. And I will say, Mr. Gunner did a hell of a sell job here, because he did exactly what you would expect somebody like him to do if you got smacked over the head with a beer bottle. He collapsed in a heap. He died. He fell down on the floor and he lay dead on the ground. And he did a good job, so I applaud him. He did a better job than a lot of other non-wrestlers coming in who have to take bumps and sell do. I won't put him quite on the same level as the Miz's dad. Okay, Miz's dad is still number one as far as wrestling dads are concerned. Mr. Cena is also in the he's got to be in the argument, but I thought Gunnar's dad did a good job here for what he was expected to do. The only thing, and again, I have to say this because it bothered me watching this. So, Gunnar is cuffed to the top rope. His father just had a beer bottle smashed over his head, right in front of his face, not even 5 feet in front of him, okay? Not even. And he's laid out, and James Storm is standing there. Now, if that happened to my father, if that happened to somebody that I loved, they had a beer bottle smashed over their head right in front of my face, and the guy who did it is standing right there, even though I'm handcuffed, I'm going to be flailing around. I'm going to be freaking out. I'm going to be cussing, spitting, trying to kick. I mean, I'm going to be doing everything I can to get at this son of a bitch. And Gunnar didn't do that. He just kind of stood there. He had kind of a shocked look on his face, but he didn't react the way that I think somebody in that position would have reacted. Like, the last time I saw an angle like this where somebody was handcuffed to the ropes and one of their loved ones was taken advantage of was the Triple H Randy Orton angle from 2009 when Orton laid out Triple H's wife. Okay, so Stephanie's out on the ground. And Orton is basically, you know, he's kissing her. It's like he's like sexually assaulting her right in front of Triple H. And Triple H's reaction, even though he was cuffed, was what you would expect. He lost his mind. He absolutely lost his mind. He's flailing around. He's trying to, like, break the ropes to get over and kill Randy Orton. And Gunnar didn't really have that reaction here. So that kind of made it look weird to me. But aside from that, I thought this was a good segment. I thought it added a lot of good heat to this feud between the two of them, which is going to continue, obviously. And I liked it. I liked this segment. Gail Kim cut a promo saying that if she beat Lady Tappa tonight, she's gone from TNA. How she can make that stipulation, I don't know. MVP never bothered to comment on this, but apparently Gail Kim can make stipulations now. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Gail beat her with the Eat Defeat. And shortly thereafter, TNA put a statement out on their website saying that Lady Tappa had been released. That is a shoot. So she is gone. That would explain why they did that rush job on breaking them up last week, but it does not explain why they had to get rid of her so quickly. You know, they had them together for many months, and it still doesn't make sense to me that you wouldn't build to a split and then build to a match and then have her lose and then kick her to the curb. But they seem to be in an awfully big rush to get rid of her, so maybe she did something that we're not aware of. I don't know, but she is gone from TNA. We then had the backstage segment with MVP and Willow. You heard the audio at the beginning of the show. Yes, Jeff Hardy, unfortunately, is back on drugs. I said last week that the Willow thing just comes off to me as goofy. I liked the vignettes that built up to it. I really genuinely wanted to see where they went. I was not all that familiar with the Willow character. I didn't follow it in Omega. I know that he showed up as Willow the Wisp once at a Ring of Honor show many years ago and got booed out of the building. That's all I knew about Willow. So I was curious to see what form the character would take, and when I saw it, I wasn't impressed, because they openly acknowledge it's Jeff Hardy. Everybody knows it's Jeff Hardy, and Jeff Hardy is not some, you know, enhancement guy, some mid-card guy. He's one of the biggest stars they've got in that company. And he's walking around like a jackass. So he's up in the rafters now. I guess Sting's not there anymore, so now Willow gets to take his spot up in the rafters. I guess the rent must be really good. And MVP goes to talk to him because Eric Young's gone. He got taken to the hospital, and somebody has to be chained to Abyss in that main event. God forbid we should kick Abyss out of ringside. You know, after all, MVP is the director of wrestling operations. Apparently he doesn't have a fucking scrotum, so he can't make that decision. So somebody's got to be out there chained to this guy. And he's begging Jeff Hardy, it's got to be you. You know, you've taken out all these other people. Now you can get your revenge. You can get your revenge on Magnus, who beat you for the world title by being chained to his monster and helping to keep the monster out of the match. And you heard the audio already. Willow cut this very bizarre promo. It's just, the whole character is so ridiculous. The end result here is that Willow basically said, fuck off, I'm not going to do it. And he walked away. And so MVP looked like an idiot. We had a beautiful people reunion in the ring. Madison Rayne was invited out. Well, actually, first of all, Angelina Love called out Velvet Sky. Once again, tried to convince her, come on back, let's be together, let's be the beautiful people like we used to be. And they did a whole swerve deal where Velvet Sky was talking like she was going to say no, and then in the end she said yes. And so they brought out Madison Rayne. Madison Rayne used to be the third member of the beautiful people. And it's such a weird thing, because last week and then the beginning of this segment, Angelina Love is out there acting like a total babyface, okay? And Velvet Sky, too. And it's like the minute Velvet agreed to come back and be part of the beautiful people, they turned. All of a sudden, their whole attitude changed. Their whole demeanor changed. They went into, like, heel wrestling mode. So when Madison comes out and they're trying to convince her to join, you know, Angelina does this thing where it's like, be part of the beautiful people with Angelina Love and Velvet Sky and, oh yeah, Madison Rayne. So, already acting like a bunch of heels, Madison Rayne is not interested. She turns him down, she goes to the back. And later on, they had a segment with Velvet and with Angelina. Angelina's like, I don't know, maybe she's right. And, you know, Velvet says, go talk to her. Just go ahead, go talk to her. So she does. And she makes a convincing argument, and Madison says, I'll think about it. And as soon as she says, I'll think about it, and she turns around to walk away, Angelina Love attacks her from behind, throws her head first into a locker, and I think she punched her in the stomach, and she said, don't you ever embarrass me like that again. And so the battle lines have been drawn. Velvet Sky is back together with Angelina Love. They are the beautiful people. They will feud, I guess, with Madison Rayne for the title. Although I wonder, I don't know if Velvet Sky was in on that, or if they're going to pretend like Velvet Sky has no idea what happened, like the first several weeks of the Christy Hemme Sam Shaw storyline before they came to their senses, where Sam Shaw was acting all creepy and they were airing these segments, and yet Christy Hemme was still going out with the guy. It's like nobody warned her. She didn't watch the show back, and nobody bothered to tell her, hey, you're dating a psychopath. And finally, they had no choice but to acknowledge it, and it made sense. So I don't know, maybe they'll do something similar where Velvet doesn't know that Angelina attacked her. I guess we'll find out. We had the Bromans beating the Wolves and the team of Sonata and Tigre Uno to retain their tag team titles. This was a good match. I liked this. Before the match, Robbie, the Bromans were cutting a promo on Sonata and Tigre Uno, trying to get them to basically forfeit the match. And Robbie referred to the X Division champion as Hyundai Sonata. Not going to lie, that one did make me laugh. And by the way, Hyundai Sonata, great car. So they had a match that was a showcase for all three teams, really. This week it wasn't so much Sonata and Tigre Uno. They only had like a two-minute match last week. But it was a showcase for the two of them. Everybody got a chance to shine in this match. I was impressed with the Bromans. I was impressed with the Wolves. At one point they had, I think it was Tigre Uno, and they had him up for like a powerbomb. But out of the powerbomb position, they gave him a backstabber. It looked awesome. It looked brutal, but it looked awesome. But in the end, the Bromans win, so they retain their tag team titles. And I don't know, you know, with the Wolves, I don't know. Are they just going to transition the Wolves into a feud with the Bromans and they'll get another shot? I mean, they lost here. They lost over in Japan. You know, the Wolves now are just another team. And the main event we had, actually before the main event, we had another segment here, which was kind of came out of nowhere. It was Nux. Remember Nux from Aces and Eights? We haven't heard from too many old members of the Aces and Eights. We know that Wes Briscoe is gone. We know Garrett Bischoff is gone. But here was Nux driving in a car, and they were filming him, and he told this story about he was looking for a woman. I don't know if this was a woman he knew from college. They showed pictures of them back when they were much younger, and he's on this journey to find this woman, to reconnect with her, maybe an old flame. He said, he talked a little bit about his family, his father did not approve of him getting into wrestling. His father runs a carnival business, and they wanted him to get into it, but he had bigger hopes and aspirations, and he hasn't talked to his father in 2.5 years, and now he's hoping to change all of that. It was this really heartfelt segment with this guy who used to come out on television every week and beat the fuck out of people with a hammer and tried to kill TNA. But this was a very emotional segment, and I guess they're going to have more with him. They'll continue the story of Nux going forward. We'll learn more about him. So this was kind of weird. Main event was Magnus and Samoa Joe for the World Heavyweight Championship. MVP decided, you know what, nobody else wants to be chained to Abyss, so fuck it. I'll bite the bullet here. I'll be at ringside. So it was Abyss and MVP chained to each other. Why, I don't know, because it never came into play until the end of the match. They just kind of stood there. Nothing happened. The referee got bumped. And then, you know, Abyss attacked MVP. He went to go bring thumbtacks into the ring. MVP attacked him. He threw the tacks away. MVP got laid out with a chair shot. And the closing sequence of the match had Samoa Joe and his infinite wisdom, who sees Abyss on the outside with the steel chair. He does a tope headfirst into the chair. Abyss just whacks him right in the head with the chair, knocks him out. Magnus comes off the top rope with his elbow smash. 1, 2, 3, Magnus wins. Joe is pinned. I assume that spells the end of Samoa Joe as a world title contender. I don't know if he's going to transition into a feud now with MVP, if he's going to transition into a feud with Eric Young, who was not there for him, which was the original plan. But I think Joe's title aspirations for now are done. And that's how the show went off the air. Another win for Magnus, where he needs help from the outside. But he's playing the role of pussy heel. That's what they've established him as. He has no credibility whatsoever, and so it is what it is. You know, we've got a pussy as a world champion in TNA that nobody can take seriously. Meanwhile, the best heel in the company is busy doing whatever bullshit he's doing with Bully Ray. And that was Impact on Thursday. Not a terrible show, but there wasn't really much to like here, you know, other than the tag title match, the James Storm Gunner stuff. Everything else was trash. I mean, there was nothing else about this show that stood out to me as being good. And that's not good either, because Impact this week did not do very well. Now, I'm sure, you know, the NCAA stuff and all that had something to do with it, but their audience was down to their lowest level since Thanksgiving. They had less than 1 million people watching their show on Thursday. If people were buying what they were doing, that would not be happening. Their audience would not be wilting away. This has been the pattern now for the last several weeks. Impact had some really good numbers. Go back like a month, month and a half. And ever since then, it's just been this downward spiral. So for their sake, hopefully it was just the basketball games and everything that took a chunk out of their audience, because if their numbers don't climb back up next week and the week after, they're in trouble. They're in trouble because they still have not signed the new TV deal with Spike TV. Their deal is up in the fall. They have not reached a new deal yet. So for Impact's ratings to start going down right now, that's not good for them. This is absolutely not the time they want their numbers to be going down. Not with Jeff Jarrett breathing down their neck. TNA is supposedly running the Manhattan Center sometime this summer. Jason Powell of ProWrestling.net broke that news earlier in the week. Originally, he said that they were going to be running 3 different dates at the Hammerstein Ballroom. One in June, one in July, and one in August. Now it sounds like they won't actually be running the Hammerstein Ballroom, but rather they'll be running the Grand Ballroom. If they run the venue at all. Now, for those who don't know, the Grand Ballroom is on the 8th floor of the Manhattan Center. The Manhattan Center is the main building, okay? On the 8th floor is the Grand Ballroom. Not the Hammerstein Ballroom, which is on the 1st floor when you first walk in. That's where Ring of Honor has a lot of their shows. That's where WWE had the one-night stand pay-per-views, came many years ago. The Grand Ballroom on top is where WWE taped those first few months of Monday Night Raw back in 1993. So it's not quite as big. It looks similar, but it's not quite as big as the Hammerstein. If they have shows there, it sounds like it'll be there, not in the Hammerstein itself. But still, I think in the Grand Ballroom, you could you could still fit over 1,000 people, maybe 1,500 or something. You know, can TNA fill that building for one show, let alone three in a row? That's a tall order that you're expecting out of this company. And we don't have any dates yet, so we don't know exactly when they are running, but they definitely have had people there to survey the site. I don't know if any contracts have been signed. It's possible this whole thing could fall through. But it does sound like they're going to be running in New York City at that building at least. If not one show for those 3 months, they may be doing TV tapings for a few days in a row. You know, it's funny. TNA never ran a pay-per-view in New York City. And New York, at one point, was always like the most rabid, I mean, aside from the UK, the most rabid market maybe in this country for their product. Those first few years when they came here to Brooklyn, and I went to those shows at the baseball stadium when they did the baseball shows out at in Coney Island. I mean, that first show had like 5,500 people. Now, ever since then, it's gone down and down and down. I think the year after that, it was down to like 4,000, then it was down to 3,000. So they, you know, the numbers have not recovered from the first time they came out to Brooklyn. And I wonder if they do come to the Manhattan Center, if that means no Brooklyn show this year. Because I've gone to all of them, and they've done it for like 4 years in a row. But I can never understand in all these years why they never paid to run a pay-per-view in New York. Because I just think, especially to do a pay-per-view, go back a few years at the Hammerstein, you know, probably would have been huge for the company. But they never did it. I don't think this is for a pay-per-view, unless they do one of those one-night-only tapings. I guess it's always possible. But it can't be cheap to run that building, and you just wonder what they're thinking to do that now when they had to get off the road, they had to go back to Orlando, and they may have to go back on the road for some dates because they can't book Universal Studios for all their tapings. They're going to have to book somewhere else because they don't have access to that soundstage, you know, for the rest of the year. I mean, there's only a few months where they will, so they're going to have to find other locations, but to run in New York City now seems like an awfully weird move to me when they're having money issues and they're letting people go left and right and they let some of their biggest stars go because they can't afford them, but yet they can afford to run the Manhattan Center in New York City. Seems kind of odd to me. We'll see when they make an official announcement, but it does sound like they're moving ahead with those plans. Let's move on to the mailbag here. If you have questions, you can always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. You could also send in MP3 questions. If you want to attach an MP3, please put the text of your question in the body of the email as well, but you can send those to me too. Ryan writes in. He's a new listener. Do you think gimmick pay-per-views make it close to impossible to write a decent storyline that is interesting and makes sense? Elimination Chamber, Money in the Bank, Hell in a Cell, and TLC all have to have their gimmick matches fitted into the storyline, when in reality, a Hell in a Cell match should be used to end a good feud, not just because it's that time of year. Well, I've said that before. I know you're a new listener, but I've said that numerous times before, that the Chamber and the Money in the Bank shows are okay. I wouldn't have a Money in the Bank show myself. I'd prefer that they do the Money in the Bank match at WrestleMania. But the Chamber pay-per-view is fine. The Money in the Bank pay-per-view is fine. Hell in a Cell and TLC are the ones that I have a problem with, especially Hell in a Cell. Like you said, Hell in a Cell should be a gimmick that's used to blow off a feud. It's bad enough. I know we can't have blood anymore, and so it's not the same. But Hell in a Cell should be used to climax a big feud between two guys. And instead, it's October, so it's time for Hell in a Cell. And that just doesn't work. And Hell in a Cell, the pay-per-views have not done as well, you know, progressively year by year. I think generally the number of buys go down. Now, that may not be an issue for them anymore, because by October, I think they're hoping that most people are watching these pay-per-views on the network, and they're not buying them for 50 or 60 bucks anymore. And so you wonder if by doing that, if they lose interest, well, I mean, maybe they already have lost interest in caring what people think, but maybe they won't have the same kind of incentive to make changes, to make these events feel more special, because they're all just part of the network. They already have your money. You're already a subscriber. So they don't care. And if they haven't gotten rid of the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view by now, I don't think they have any plans of getting rid of it anytime soon. So that's what I don't like about that one. TLC is kind of the same thing. A TLC match, to just have one for the sake of having one. Why? Make it special. So I agree. I'm not a fan of the gimmick shows. Cameron from London, do you remember Rikishi's splash from the top of the cage against Val Venus? How come WWE doesn't bring up that moment? You know what? That's a really good question. I don't know. When we see video packages and stuff, they don't show that, do they? I'll never forget it. I remember that pay-per-view. It was Fully Loaded 2000. I remember that show. If you want to go back and watch it on the network, that's the one to look for. Fully Loaded 2000. I remember watching Rikishi. It's one thing to climb to the top of the cage. A lot of guys do that, like, in the corner. They'll climb to the top, and they'll do a moonsault, or they'll do a splash, or something completely dumb. But what Rikishi did, and he was 400 pounds. Let's say legit he was, you know what, he probably was a legit 400. I mean, maybe he was 350, but I think he was a lot bigger than that. Let's say he was a legit 400 pounds, 380, whatever. Okay, he's a big guy. For him to climb to the top of the cage and stand up is scary enough, but I remember watching him inch his way slowly from the corner of the cage where he climbed up to the middle. So he didn't have anything to hang on to. There was no railing. He inched his way over. I mean, just thinking about it, because I'm afraid of heights, and just to think about that now is freaking me out. So I remember watching that thinking, oh my God, he's going to die. He's going to die, and he's going to take out the first five rows of fans if he falls backwards. But he kept his balance, and the camera focused, and he's standing right in the middle of the cage. He looks up into the camera, and he does the big Superfly splash off the top. And I'll give a lot of credit to Val Venus for taking that move. I'm sure he got the wind knocked out of him on that one. And that, you know what? A spot like that should be the end. That's it. That should be the finish of the match right there. And I think that was a big mistake not letting Rikishi, because he didn't even win the match. There was a bullshit finish. I think Taz, like, slammed the cage door on his head or something, and Val got the pin. That should have been the end of the match right there. I can't think of a bigger high spot than that. And he should have won the Intercontinental title right then and there. But you're right. I don't really remember them using that footage in any of their video packages of big highlights and moments in time. You know, Hogan slamming Andre, Brock giving the Big Show the F5 for the first time, and all of Cena's feats of strength. To me, that's a moment that should stand the test of time also, because it was pretty incredible to see a guy that big not just climb to the top, but move around the way he was, and then to jump off was a big moment. Danny Liu, who composed most of the theme music for WCW? I really feel WCW put out lots of underrated theme songs in its history, like Harlem Heat, Scott Steiner, Sting, DDP, NWO, and Goldberg. I know Jimmy Hart was involved in the creation of a lot of that music. I don't know that he was the only one, but he had a lot to do with a lot of those songs. And you're right about a lot of them, especially DDP. When DDP came over to WWE, and they gave him, as they do with a lot of guys apparently, like Adam Rose now, they give them a knockoff version of a better song, and it's not the same. And the entrance is so important to a lot of these guys. So DDP's music, we all know, was a knockoff of a Nirvana song. I assume the reason they didn't use it was because they didn't have the rights. That seems to always be the issue. We don't have the rights. We don't want to pay for the rights. So they came up with this generic instrumental version of DDP's old music, and it sucked. It just wasn't the same. But DDP's original music in WCW was awesome. It was great. I agree. There were a lot of good theme songs in WCW. The NWO, they didn't create the NWO. I assume they bought the rights for it. The NWO music, I remember when I first heard the NWO music and I was online looking for it. And the internet was still in its infancy back then compared to the way it is now. So people looked around for music and all you could find were 30-second clips. And that's all you needed. You just needed a 30-second clip and you could just loop it and listen to it all day long. And I remember reading that the NWO music was used in a porn video. Some porn movie. I don't know if it was just one or multiple ones. But that whoever came up with that music to use that for the NWO probably first saw it in a porno flick. So you may never look at the NWO thing the same way again, but that's where it came from. But they had a lot of good music. Terrell from Atlanta, do you think Triple H does not have enough faith in the roster to sell WrestleMania as a whole, and so he's banking on his main event to be the money grabber? I think it has less to do with faith and more to do with him needing to always have a prime spot on the card. You know, he's got to have his big match at WrestleMania. And keep in mind, you know, he also gets a big payday out of it. Not that he needs it, but when you look at the executive compensation figures that they released, they just released a whole bunch of salary figures for Vince McMahon and Kevin Dunn and people like that, because they are a publicly traded company, so that information is out there. If you look, it's something people, I don't think, really pay too much attention to, but Triple H, makes a lot of money as a talent when he wrestles at WrestleMania. And a show like this year, especially if he's in more than one match, if he weasels his way into the main event somehow, but even if he doesn't, you know, he's in the biggest match on that card. I would say Triple H and Bryan is the biggest feature attraction on that show. So he's going to get a nice payday out of it. I don't know if it'll be a million, but he's going to make a lot of money. Because I guess he has a separate contract as a talent, not just an executive. So it's in his best interest to always be in a headline position at WrestleMania because he can make a shit ton of money. Latif writes in, I thought about how wrestlers wrestle virtually every day with no days off. A lot of these guys' bodies are broken down, going through years of countless surgeries and chronic pain. One thing WWE once said in a promo is that there is no off-season. I personally think a lot of the wrestlers would really benefit from an off-season. They would have more time to heal from the bumps they take during matches. At least guys can come back more refreshed and ready to go. Has WWE ever thought about having any kind of off-season, and what are your thoughts about pro wrestling having an off-season? I don't know if they've ever considered it or not. I'm guessing not. It probably hasn't come up seriously, at least not in WWE. They would just lose too much money. It's not practical for them to do that because they're running constantly, every week, all year long, live events, Raws, SmackDown pay-per-views, and I'm sure USA Network or whoever their TV partner is would not be happy if they said, hey, we're going to take 2 months off or we're going to take 3 months off. Because the question is, okay, you want to have an off-season, fine. How long is your off-season? I mean, is it 2 months? Is it 4 months? Because you're talking about chronic pain and bumps and everything, right? What are you going to give them, a month? That's not going to do anything. It's got to be at least 2 months, maybe three. It's too much time. It's too long. And the wrestlers aren't going to be very happy because you're taking money out of their pocket. So my solution to this, or at least what I think they should try, and I've said this before, is you rotate guys out. So you have a set schedule where, whether it's a main event guy or a mid-card guy, let's say Randy Orton. Randy Orton, for that particular year, has a designated period of time where he is required to take time off, whether he's hurt or not, whether he's the champion or not. And you would have to probably make sure he's not the champion at that point, have him drop the title beforehand. But mandatory. Orton, in September, from this week to this week, you're getting 2 weeks off, or you're getting 3 weeks off. You can have one long big period where they get a whole bunch of weeks off, or you can break it up where twice a year you get 2 weeks off here, you get 2 weeks off there. I know that's not a lot of time, but I think that would be the smart way to do it. And when you rotate him out, you make sure that whatever he's involved in, whatever big storyline he may be involved in, you wrap it up. So him being gone doesn't impact anything. And you don't have it where two big top guys have time off at the exact same time. John Cena and Randy Orton should not have their time off at the exact same time. They have to work the schedule where when Orton's gone, other guys can pick up the slack. If Bryan's gone, other people can pick up the slack. And then you work it like that. You have somebody in charge of that schedule. I think that, to me, would make more sense because that way you can keep things going. The business keeps going. You keep making money, but you're giving individual guys time off. And I think that would make a lot more sense if they can work that schedule out. Maybe it's not practical. I haven't sat down and tried to do it myself. Maybe I'm talking out of my ass. I just think having an off-season is not going to work. It's just not. So as an alternative, you have this rotating schedule of vacation time, basically, for people. Ben from Newcastle, England, I was just listening to Mick Foley on JR's podcast, and it reminded me about his and Dean Ambrose's almost feud. Where do you think Dean would be if that feud had gone ahead, and how would this have impacted the Shield? I think he would have been worse off for it. I mean, there's no way to know for sure, but, you know, Dean Ambrose, was it WrestleMania 27 or 28? I don't remember, but they started something with him and Foley. I remember Foley was, I think, in town for WrestleMania weekend, and somebody was filming him in the lobby of a hotel, and Dean Ambrose was, like, interrupting or trying to, like, troll him or whatever he was doing. So they started in that direction, and then they quickly dropped it. So it's not like some internet rumor, and Foley's talked about this too. It was going to happen. Had it happened, it would have been big exposure for Ambrose working with Foley right out of the bat, but I don't know, you know, Foley can't wrestle. Even then, I don't think Foley could do a match, so I'm not sure where that feud would have gone. It would have been big for Ambrose at first, but I think that probably what would have happened is Ambrose would have just fallen into the mid-card and they wouldn't have had any plans for him. At least this way, these three guys together are perfect. They are the perfect team, and they all got pushed the same way. They were protected. They all bring something different to the table. Rollins is a great wrestler and a great bumper, and he's become a great talker. Ambrose is the crazy guy of the group, the loose cannon. Reigns is the muscle, right? He's the enforcer. And they all bring something different to the table, and they've all been in the mix. They've been in the main event mix now for pretty much all of their run. And I think when they split the Shield up, and I hope they don't for a while, but when they do, all three guys are already primed to be big stars. But, you know, if Ambrose comes in by himself, and he has one big program with Foley, what do you do with him then? I don't trust that they would have had something planned. Like, okay, after the Foley thing is over, we got big plans for this Dean Ambrose guy. He probably would have been like Wade Barrett or something. You know, they would have been like, we got nothing for this guy. We got to come up with like a funny gimmick for him. So I think it paid off. I think it worked out well. And even Foley has said he's happy. He's happy that plans got dropped and things worked out the way they did because the Shield is so great. So I don't think it would have worked out too well for Ambrose, but the Shield, I think, would have been fine. I think they would have had Rollins, they would have had Reigns, and they could have plugged somebody else in that spot. I don't know if it would have been a Corey Graves, if it would have been a Cassius Ohno, maybe they would have pushed him up sooner, maybe he'd still have a job with them. And I'm not saying they would have been better than Ambrose, but I think Rollins is so good in his role and Reigns is so good in his role that even if there was somebody in there who wasn't as strong of a personality as Ambrose, I think the Shield would have been just fine. But Ambrose, by himself, I don't think would have fared as well. Nathan from Toronto, I had the idea that the Raw after WrestleMania, Daniel Bryan would come out thanking the fans, saying where this is where it all began. Then Orton would come out, Batista would come out, Triple H would come out, having all the members of Evolution in the ring, minus Ric Flair, about to attack Bryan when the Shield's music hits. They enter the ring to protect Bryan and have a stare down. What I'm asking you is, do you see an Evolution versus Shield match happening at some point after WrestleMania? That is a very interesting idea. Batista's a heel, Orton's a heel, Triple H is a heel. You can do something where they, I don't know if they reunite as a group. Actually, that's not going to happen, but have them form some sort of alliance, come together to beat down Bryan after he wins the belt of Mania. Shield comes to his rescue, and you can, what it sets up is a series of six-man or eight-man tag that you can do. I don't know that Triple H is going to want to wrestle on Raw. He may want to save his appearances for pay-per-views. But to build to Triple H, Orton, and Batista, maybe in one other person, not Ric Flair, but whoever that person is, against Bryan, Rollins, Reigns, and Ambrose, I think that'd be a hell of a match. I like that idea a lot, actually, because it keeps the Shield together. And, you know, Bryan's the champion, and he's still in the mix, and they've got three solid heels to go up against. The question, I guess, is you could do six-mans, have it be Triple H, Batista, and Orton, but where does Bryan fit into that? Because you got three members of the Shield, and Bryan, that's four. So you need a fourth person to partner up with Triple H, Orton, and Batista. You know what? Why not Bray Wyatt? You know, Bray Wyatt's got Harper and Rowan, who can kind of be in his corner, but maybe they forge some sort of alliance, you know, like there's a common theme here. Bray Wyatt has had his issues clearly with the Shield, and he's left them laying. He pinned Roman Reigns at Elimination Chamber, and he had his issues with Daniel Bryan, who was part of his group, and he beat him at the Royal Rumble. So maybe the Evolution guys make an offer to Bray Wyatt, and Bray Wyatt can fill that fourth spot where it's Bray and the Evolution guys against Bryan and the Shield. I don't know if you would do that on a pay-per-view or if you would do that on Raw. I would love to see a match like that. Absolutely. I don't see Evolution ever getting back together as a faction. But I think to do kind of a one-off program or a one-off match, that'd be a great idea. But it goes back to what I said earlier about Bray Wyatt and John Cena at WrestleMania. You know, if they wanted to plug Bray into what you just proposed, like I said, he's had his issues with the Shield, and he's beaten them. He's had his issues with Bryan, and he's beaten them, which should set him up as a number one contender for the title. But he's got to beat Cena at WrestleMania. I feel like if you're going to involve Bray in something like that, and he's got all these other guys that he's beaten, right? And so he's been built up to be this dominant force. To have him lose to John Cena at WrestleMania makes no sense. So I think it's even more important that he win that match at WrestleMania. And finally here, Andrew in Fort Erie, Ontario, another Canadian listener. What is your favorite national anthem performance from WrestleMania? I did not see all of them, but my favorite was Little Richard with the choir at WrestleMania 10. I'm going to go with Mean Gene Okerlund singing the Star Spangled Banner at the first WrestleMania. All those celebrities, and nobody thought to ask any of them to sing the anthem. They had to have Mean Gene do it. If not him, I would go with Lillian Garcia any of the years that she's done it, because she is the best at it that I've ever heard.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, 20 years ago this week on March 20th, 1994, WrestleMania 10, Madison Square Garden, Jerry the King Lawler made a surprise return to the announce booth with Vince McMahon after being gone for about 4 months. He was fighting rape charges made by an underage girl, which were later dropped. We had the classic match between Bret and Owen Hart, who opened the show. Probably still to this day the best opening match in WrestleMania history. One of the best matches, period, in WrestleMania history. Originally, Bruce Hart was supposed to be in the Owen Hart spot, feuding with Bret, but Bret wanted Owen, and more specifically, did not want Bruce. I think that was Pat Patterson's choice, and so Bret got that vetoed. Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon had their classic ladder match on this show, the one that set the standard by which all other ladder matches are measured, largely because it was the first one most people ever saw. Shawn Michaels had been the Intercontinental Champion. He was reportedly suspended for a steroid failure, so the title was vacant. Razor Ramon won it in a battle royal. They brought Shawn back a few months later. He still had the old belt, and so that's why both belts were suspended above the ring for this match. Macho Man Randy Savage made his final WrestleMania appearance, beating Crush in a Falls Count Anywhere match. Alundra Blaze beat Leilani Kai, the only person in WrestleMania history to have competed on the first WrestleMania show and the 10th one. Matt Bourne did wrestle on the first WrestleMania card, but by this point, I think it was Rey Apollo under the Doink mask for the mixed tag with Doink and Dink against Bam Bam and Luna, so he doesn't count. We had Lex Luger and Yokozuna in the first of two championship matches at WrestleMania. This was the first and only time they ever did this. Bret and Luger co-won the 1994 Royal Rumble. They had a coin toss on TV to determine who would get the first title shot. And so Luger won the coin toss. And that meant that Luger would have the first shot against Yokozuna. Bret would have to face his brother earlier in the night, which he did, and he lost. And the Luger-Yoko match ended with a controversial decision. Mr. Perfect disqualified Lex Luger. Mr. Perfect was the surprise guest referee that came out that night. So he screwed over Luger, and then in the main event, Bret Hart won the championship from Yokozuna with Roddy Piper as the guest referee, and that ushered in that whole new generation era that really Bret, I guess Bret and Shawn, but more so Bret was the face of that new generation era for the company, and that this is where it all started in 94. I just remember being very upset when Hulk Hogan didn't come out as the special referee for the main event, and instead it was Roddy Piper. Hogan had been on every single Mania card up until this point. He wasn't doing anything. I think he was filming Thunder in Paradise. He had not joined WCW yet. This was a few months before that. So I thought for sure he was going to be the referee, and much to my chagrin at that time, he wasn't. No Undertaker on this show. The first WrestleMania that he missed, he was taking some time off. And there was supposed to be a 10-man tag, but it got bumped to Raw 2 weeks later because the ladder match went long. I talked about this in my Sound Off Extra review of the Bob Holly book, which is up right now on our YouTube channel. Holly was supposed to be in that match, and he tells the story of how Randy Savage went ballistic on Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon when they came back through the curtain backstage. You know, they had that awesome match, and people were probably complimenting them on it and everything. But he went off on them for being selfish and taking money out of other people's pockets by ignoring their time cues. This is one of the better WrestleMania shows they've ever done. I can't call it the best, but if you made a top five list, I could see WrestleMania 10 being on that list, maybe at number four or five. It was a good show. I went to the Fan Fest. It was the first time they had a Fan Fest event in conjunction with WrestleMania. Now they call it Fan Access. So I went to the Fan Fest. I didn't go to WrestleMania itself. That's where those pictures come from on my Facebook page. If you look in the Secret Files album, if there's pictures of me with Vince McMahon, Shawn Michaels, and a few other people. They had a dunk doink tank there where you can dunk them in water. I don't know who was playing doink. Bushwhackers were there. They were licking people. Fun times. But really depressing to look at this card and realize that nine of the people on this show are dead. Owen, Savage, Crush, Bam Bam, Luna, Mabel, Earthquake, Kurt Hennig, and Yokozuna, all gone. Only one of them was over the age of 50 when they died. Think about that. 19 years ago this week, on March 19, 1995, WCW held its first ever uncensored pay-per-view in Tupelo, Mississippi. And what a show this was. Meng beat Hacksaw Jim Duggan in a martial arts match with Sonny Ono as the guest referee. We had Johnny B. Badd beating Arn Anderson in a boxer versus wrestler match. Blacktop Bully beat Dustin Rhodes in a King of the Road match, which was taped a few days earlier and filmed on the back of a moving 18-wheeler. Oh, yes. This turned out to be a pretty significant match because both guys... What happened is both guys bladed, which is why it was so edited when it aired. You know, it was significant because at the time, blading was not allowed in WCW. So both guys got fired when the match was over. As well as Mike Graham, I think, who was the agent in charge and who told them both to blade. I think he was also the one driving the truck. But it was significant also because that opened the door for Dustin to go to WWF a few months later and become Goldust for the very first time. We had Macho Man Randy Savage beating Avalanche by disqualification after Ric Flair, who was masquerading as a fan, dressed in drag, interfered in the match. This after the match and the entire pay-per-view was billed as being no disqualification. It was a disqualification in this match. Nasty Boys beat Harlem Heat in a Falls Count Anywhere match, Texas Tornado style. They ended up in the concession stands with them using things like cotton candy to attack one another. So I guess I take it back. Maybe all the guys in TNA using cardboard isn't so bad after all when you're using freaking cotton candy on your opponent. So they were using cotton candy, and Knobs slammed Booker T onto a funnel cake stand at one point. And in the main event, Hulk Hogan beat Vader in a strap match after Hogan dragged Ric Flair to all four corners of the ring. Now let me repeat that. Hulk Hogan beat Vader to retain his title after dragging Ric Flair to all four corners of the ring. Reason being, neither guy wanted to do the job for the other. So as a compromise, they had Flair be the one to lose the match, even though he wasn't officially in the match. Because, again, Hulk Hogan's WCW, that's all Ric Flair ever did, was lose. Funny thing about that is it was on that same date, March 19th, 5 years later, that the final WCW Uncensored pay-per-view took place in Miami. And the main event for that show? Hulk Hogan beating Ric Flair in a strap match. By pinfall. It gets better. Just when you think WCW can't get any worse, it's somehow they managed to find a way to top themselves. Is it any wonder why this company went out of business a year later? Is it really that shocking? I can't see how it could be shocking to anybody anymore. This was the infamous Yappapai Indian strap match, named after the Yappapai Indian tribe. Or as Hulk Hogan seemed to call it in his promos leading up to it, the Apple Pie Indian strap match.
The main priority in the Yappapai Indian strap match is to have flexibility on the wrist that you're strapped to your opponent with, brother. Because in the Yappapai Indian strap match, when you're in the four corners of the battle zone, the main priority is to get the body in the proper position for the strapation dudes. And as I see the raw pink meat, I will double strap you with both fists and you will scream to the heavens, "Please, Hollywood, don't hurt me anymore," and I will never stop.
You know, the scary thing is, that isn't the first time another wrestler has threatened Ric Flair in a sexual way.
There's one part of our bodies that's soft, and it ain't soft all the time, if you catch my meaning. Ric Flair, you're gonna find out what hard is all about.
Threatening to rape your opponent, probably not a good way to promote a match. 17 years ago this week, on March 23rd, 1997, WrestleMania 13 featured Bret Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin in a submission match with Ken Shamrock as the guest referee. This is one of the greatest WrestleMania matches in history. It's one of the greatest WWE matches in company history. It was a great match, but also for what it accomplished. It solidified Bret as a heel, or at least it kicked off didn't really kick off his heel turn. That's not really right. I mean, he was already showing signs of kind of being the whiny, crybaby Bret Hart before then, but that really sealed the deal, I think, as far as him being a heel and the crowd's reaction. And then the promo he ended up doing a week or two later on Raw where he just told the American wrestling fans to kiss his ass. Steve Austin was launched into the stratosphere largely as a result of this match. They did the double turn. Austin juiced. He had blood streaming down his face. It was great. Just great emotion. Great post-match stuff, even with Shamrock suplexing Bret Hart over. The crowd's going nuts. It really was a one-match show. There was no other match on this card that came close to being as good as this match. And that included the main event with Undertaker and Sid for the title. And originally, it was going to be Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels in a WrestleMania 12 rematch for the championship. That was what everything was building towards until Shawn came down with what Bret Hart would call his phony knee injury, lost his smile, gave up the title. It was always funny to me how Shawn came out. He was very convincing on that Raw show where he said he lost his smile and he gave up the belt and his eyes were all red and he was crying and talked about how this could be a career-threatening injury. Didn't say it was, but he said it could be. And yet, a month later, I don't even think it was a month and a half, it was about a month later, he's at WrestleMania, he doesn't have a match, but he's at WrestleMania, he's out there for the main event to do commentary, and he's dancing around. There's no limp, there's no crutch, there's no cane, he didn't just walk. He's dancing around like he feels fine. And I'm like, yeah, knee injury, my ass. So I think Bret Hart hit the nail on the head with that one, so he wasn't very happy because it kind of threw everything into disarray. Believe me, the plan was not to have Shawn Michaels sit and do commentary for the main event of WrestleMania. He was supposed to be in that match, defending his title against Bret Hart, and doing the honors for Bret, as Bret did for him the year before, and it didn't quite work out that way. But for Steve Austin, it worked out very nicely. 13 years ago this week, on March 23rd, 2001, the day that changed the wrestling business forever. It was the day that WWE officially bought out their competition, WCW. They put out a press release saying, World Wrestling Federation Entertainment today announced its purchase of the World Championship Wrestling brand from Turner Broadcasting System, a division of AOL Time Warner. Purchase of WCW creates a tag team partnership with the WWE brand that is expected to propel the sports entertainment genre to new heights. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. In keeping with the company's strategic alliance with Viacom, new WCW programming is anticipated to air on TNN in the near future. The possibility of cross-brand storylines and intrigue, however, may start as early as Raw this coming Monday night. This is a quote now from Linda McMahon. She said, "This acquisition is the perfect creative and business catalyst for our company. This is a dream combination for fans of sports entertainment. The incendiary mix of World Wrestling Federation and WCW personalities potentially create intriguing storylines that will attract a larger fan base to the benefit of our advertisers and business partners and propel sports entertainment to new heights." You know, when I think back to that day and everything that happened, and now reading this, because I went back, I found the press release, I'm reading all this garbage, and it makes me sad. You know, I mean, WCW deserved to die. Make no mistake about it. They got exactly what they deserved because lots of different people ran that company into the ground. I'm surprised it even lasted as long as it did. The way that they treated that company and the booking and everything else and all the stupid decisions, they deserved to die. But it's a shame that it had to happen because it hurt so many different people. It hurt fans. It hurt the wrestlers. It hurt everybody. And here you read them, oh, it's going to launch wrestling to new heights. Didn't happen. It's going to attract new audiences to wrestling. Didn't happen. All it did was it drove away the old WCW audience who wanted nothing to do with WWF. And there were old WCW fans who kind of stuck around a little bit at the beginning and they were curious. They wanted to see where it was going to go. And they didn't like what they saw and they abandoned ship. And a lot of those guys never came back. And WWE to this day is always trying to attract those old wrestling fans. Maybe not the WCW ones, but they're always talking about a lapsed audience, right? They're thinking of like the Attitude Era fans. They're always trying to get back those old people. But they chased away so many WCW fans the way they handled this at the beginning. It pisses me off just to think back to what they had and how they pissed it all away. And even in their own press release, they admit it. They admit that there was going to be a WCW show on TNN. Again, the plan, as I understood it, was always for WCW to take over the Raw spot. to give Raw to WCW, whether they would have called it Raw or not, I don't know, and then let the WWE guys have their time on SmackDown on Thursdays. Now, I don't know that I would have done it that way. I wouldn't have given up Raw for them, but that's how serious they were. You know, Vince McMahon was serious. He said the only way to make this a success is you've got to go all out, and you can't give them SmackDown, because SmackDown is always going to be the number two show. You know, he had enough foresight to know that if we're going to make this work, we've got to make them number one. We've got to give them that prime real estate on Monday nights. We'll be okay. People are going to tune in to find The Rock and Stone Cold and all of our guys on Thursday nights, but they had plans in place, and they just pissed it all away. It was that Booker T. Buff Bagwell match in Tacoma, Washington, and Vince pitched a fit because the match sucked. And the crowd crapped all over it because to them, WCW was the enemy and we have to boo them and we have, you know, they're not the WWF guys, so we don't like them. We've always been conditioned to think that. Plus, the match sucked. And that was it. All those plans got dropped. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine how things might look had they moved forward. I mean, maybe it would have failed anyway and we'd be right where we are now. There's no way of knowing. It's like the biggest what-if question in the history of wrestling. You know, what if? What if this thing had actually worked and had gone off without a hitch and they tried to run two separate promotions, basically, and then build to an interpromotional supercard at WrestleMania and actually bring in big names right off the bat? Don't wait a year. Don't wait 2 years to bring in Hogan and Nash and Goldberg, and they never even brought in Sting. Get these guys at the beginning. Get them in the first, like, 6 months and slowly bring them in and roll them out. And maybe things would have worked out a little bit differently. Instead, it's Survivor Series that year. They blew the whole thing off. And everything in this press release that Linda McMahon and the other people they quote, everything they talked about from creating new programming to attracting new fans and all these different things, never happened. It never panned out. The only thing that did happen is they did mention the tape library in their press release. And that's the one thing that they've made a shitload of money on. And it's actually amazing how well the WCW DVDs are doing now. The Goldberg DVD was the number one selling DVD, I think, of the most recent quarter. And they had a War Games DVD. I think they had the Best of WCW Volume 1 that came out. Those are some of the highest performing DVDs they've done in the last year. And that's why they're doing a Volume 2. They're doing more. They want to do more WCW releases. And that's another reason why I think it's inevitable that Sting is coming in, whether he wrestles or not. I mean, you can use him to promote the DVDs. You can use him to promote the WCW content to drive people to subscribe to the network, because there's still people out there who are interested in the old stuff. They don't give a shit about the new stuff, but it's that old stuff that they want to see. There's still an audience out there for it. 12 years ago this week, on March 17, 2002, WrestleMania 18 at the Sky Dome in Toronto, Hollywood Hogan against The Rock, one of the more memorable matches in WrestleMania history, where Hogan came in as the heel, and he left as the hero, although The Rock did beat him. That was a great match. The match itself wasn't great. I take that back. It was the fans' reaction to the match. It was kind of the aura of the match, and it was great. I have fond memories of that match, and the Hulk up, and missing the leg drop, and The Rock gets the win, and everything else. Undertaker went 10-0 with a win over Ric Flair. And Triple H won the Undisputed title from Chris Jericho in something of a dud main event. 8 years ago this week, on March 18, 2006, Saturday night's main event returned to NBC for the first time since 1991. Did not do nearly as well as the Saturday night main event shows of old. But there also wasn't nearly as much wrestling on TV back then as there is now. There weren't as many channels back then as there are now. And plus now, Saturday night is a horrible night for TV. Back then, Fridays and Saturdays were some of the biggest nights for TV shows. Triple H and John Cena, who were opposing each other at WrestleMania 22, teamed up to beat Randy Orton, Rey Mysterio, and Kurt Angle, who were wrestling each other for the world title at WrestleMania. John Cena won that match, pinning Orton with a roll-up. Mickey James and Trish Stratus beat Victoria and Candice Michelle, with Mickey turning heel after the match and laying out Trish with her own moves, a chick kick and Stratus faction, to set up their title match at WrestleMania. In my opinion, the best build to a Divas match in WrestleMania history, if not the best Divas match itself in WrestleMania history still to this day. Stone Cold and JBL had a beer drinking contest, with Austin laying out JBL with a stunner, and in the main event, Shane McMahon beat Shawn Michaels with the Montreal finish. Vince McMahon called for the bell after Shane put Shawn in the sharpshooter. And finally here, 3 weeks ago this week on March 18, 2011, Chuck Ross posted a blog on the TV Week website talking about a comical exchange he had with a WWE publicist who emailed him demanding that they correct a story they posted. The headline of the story read, Drew Carey inducted into the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame. WWE had sent him a press release announcing that Drew Carey would be inducted into the celebrity wing, so they wrote a story based off the release that they got. Well, this sent this publicist off the deep end. Not only did she email Chuck Ross, she CC'd the site's owner on the email, which is a real dick thing to do, by the way. I'm in public relations, so I can see things from her point of view. She was probably only doing what she was asked to do. If I try to place a story for a client and we get that story, but there's something in there the client doesn't like, it's up to you to make good with the client, even if it's really not that big of a deal. So I get that. But I wouldn't copy the reporter's editor on the email unless they did something really awful or if they were ignoring me and it was my last resort to get their attention. I'll copy their boss on the email. That's just my two cents. Anyway, her beef was WWE is no longer a wrestling company. They are a global entertainment company with a movie studio, international licensing deals, three magazines, blah, blah, blah. From his perspective, their headline was completely accurate. There was nothing wrong with it. And he was actually offended by this demand that they change it. Like, who is this woman to demand that he do anything? So they get on the phone, and he transcribed their entire conversation, which was hilarious. He said, listen, your press release stated very clearly that Drew Carey was an entrant in the Royal Rumble in 2001. I believe that was a wrestling event. And the publicist says, no, we don't do wrestling events. They're entertainments. And we don't call them wrestlers. They're superstars and they're divas. As a fan, okay, I can live with calling them superstars. They've been superstars since I was a kid. No problem. I can live with the term sports entertainment. No problem. And I even get the whole WWE Universe thing. It's a marketing gimmick, even though it sounds completely unnatural when people say it. But fine, I get it. But entertainments? I don't know how this guy didn't tear something from laughing so hard. Entertainments. Is that even a fucking word? So at that point, he tells the woman, listen, I don't have time for this shit. WWE presents wrestling events. I'm not changing the headline. If you want, I can just get rid of the story. What do you want me to do? And she told him, remove it. And that was it. He took it down. So instead of getting some press for Drew Carey going into the Hall of Fame, instead, they got no story out of it, and they got a blog entry talking about how stupid they are. I have not seen them use the word entertainment since then, so at least they came to their senses. And that's this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag or any kind of questions at all, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. That includes MP3 questions that might get played on the air. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. We're getting awfully close to WrestleMania. I'll be in New Orleans for all the events, Hall of Fame, Raw, WrestleMania, God knows what else. And, of course, I do live tweet every Monday night during the show as well. We're getting awfully close to 5,000 followers, so if you're not already following along on there, please do so. We're on Facebook. There's a profile page, a fan page, which I would appreciate if you would like that page. I know it's been neglected for far too long, but we also have a group page on Facebook, a closed discussion group. We've had a lot of new signups recently, so if you want to sign up there, apply for membership. I will approve you. We are over the 1,700 mark now, and there's going to be a lot of discussion, I'm sure, going on between now and WrestleMania as it relates to the pay-per-view, so you'll want to be part of that. You can also subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. You can also add us to your playlist in Stitcher Radio and stream us on Stitcher every now and then if you can, because that also helps our ranking on there, the more people listen to us on there. We have a YouTube channel. You can type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You'll probably see a whole bunch of videos from our channel come up. You can subscribe from there. I'm planning on getting up the Daniel Bryan interview that we actually did 2 years ago in Miami. Now that Bryan is on this quest for the championship here, I thought it would be cool to go back 2 years and hear the full interview that we did with him in Miami. At the time, he was the world heavyweight champion. This was right before he lost to Sheamus in 18 seconds. I went back and I listened to that interview for the first time in a while yesterday, and it was actually really cool. So I'll get that full thing up on YouTube as a retro clip in the next couple of days. And just keep supporting the show. Again, if you want to make a PayPal donation, you can do so on thesolemonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname. But you can give whatever you want. I appreciate everybody who's donated or supported the show through Audible or any way. Just know that I am thankful for that. We will be back here next weekend with another episode of The Sound Off, episode 320. That will be the last, quote, normal show, I guess, before WrestleMania. 321, we're planning on doing a roundtable with WrestleMania predictions in New Orleans once we get down there. So there's a lot of fun stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks. Keep supporting the show. Keep spreading the good word. This is a good time of year to get people hooked on the show if they've never listened before. So if you want to let people know, I think they will like what they hear. At least I hope they do. And we'll see you right back here next week. So until then, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you back here next time. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to The Sala Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Sierra Hotel. India. Echo. Lima.
The bad.
And I am back to headline WrestleMania, so deal with it.
And the ugly.
Then they have a hat. The hat itself is actually nice. It looks like a nice hat.
What's wrong with this is it's a beard baseball hat. The entire brim of the hat is a hairy beard. Who the fuck would wear this?
Well, mostly the good.
You can't disregard the fans. You can't disrespect the talent. I think we all want to see a change.
Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monster Sound Off.